You are tuned in to the NTD Broadcast Network presentation of Off Camera with Sam Jones. The best conversations happen off camera.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones, and in this episode, I sit down with Val McCallum. Whether or not you've heard of Val, you've undoubtedly heard his work. Val is a supremely talented guitarist, singer, songwriter, and studio musician who got his start recording for the legendary songwriter Harry Nilsson at age 18. After 30 years of working with such artists as Jackson Browne, Lucinda Williams, The Wallflowers, Bonnie Raitt, and countless others, Val has released his first solo record. Entitled At the End of the Day, it is a collection of spare, acoustic, and grippingly intimate songs. We grabbed Val between stops on his current tour with Jackson Browne and gigs with his own wickedly humorous country band Jack Shit, where he performs as alter ego Bo Shit. Val grew up in Los Angeles and is the son of actor David McCallum and actress Jill Ireland. But Ireland raised Val with Charles Bronson, who she married when Val was a young boy. Val discovered the guitar at age 8 and arguably hung on to it for dear life through some tough twists and turns, including the tragic death of his brother Jason and the loss of his mother to cancer. In At the End of the Day, Val opens these wounds and sings with touching candor about themes that are at once deeply personal and universally human. It's a record about loss, grief, and loneliness that somehow manages to create a mood of catharsis, promise, and understanding. Reminiscent of early Neil Young, Nick Drake, and Crosby, Stills, and Nash, At the End of the Day is an achievement of understated beauty. In this episode, I talk to Val about his experiences making records with so many iconic artists and about the process of making his own. So pull up a chair and listen in. Val McCallum, thank you for coming to the show and for being our first guest, which is an honor for me, and you get to be our guinea pig. So let's jump right in. There's a lot of things I want to talk to you about. I've known you for a long time. You've recently put out a record called At the End of the Day. You are a studio musician and have done that for years and years. You even have a country band called Jack Shit. So I'd love to talk about all that stuff. But let's jump right into, I've known you a long time, but I've never asked, what was your first experience, first time in a studio playing guitar on someone else's record?
My first gig was sort of the best gig I ever had, actually. It never got any better than my first gig. It was with Harry Nilsson. And I used to be friends with Harry's lawyer's son, and I was over at their house hanging out, and Harry came over, and Harry's lawyer's wife, Ronnie Graykell, said, "Harry, you've got to listen to Val play." You know, and he said, "Oh, don't make me do that to the kid, you know." So at which point I bolted out to my car and grabbed my guitar, and you know, I sat down and showed him my chop, and he said, "What are you doing on Wednesday?" I showed up at the studio and cut the guitar solo to the single of the record within 20 minutes of being there. And it was like a dream kind of situation, you know.
No kidding. So your first gig ever, the best gig ever. So yeah, it's all downhill from there.
It was all downhill. What's my inspiration after that?
Now tell me, you know, you get in there and there's obviously a producer and an engineer and it's a serious deal. Were you intimidated or...
Well, I really wasn't intimidated when I got there because it was just sort of so unreal. I was just kind of like, you know, I was the kid, you know, from the tennis court, you know. And his producer was a guy named Rick Riccio, who I think produced some Lennon stuff. He was like a heavyweight producer. As soon as I sat down, he got right in my face, and he was like, he was upset with Harry for canceling Steve Carnelli, who is one of the best session players in town. And he got right in my face, and he was like, I don't know what he was high on, but he was like, "You know, what are you going to do?" He kept saying, "What are you going to do?" And you know, I remember saying, "Just put it in, record, you know, give me a shot." Because I knew that the track had been laid and they needed a guitar solo. And I heard it beforehand. You know, I could hear it when I arrived to the studio, and I knew it was right up my alley. It just needed to be sort of a, you know, a bluesy kind of a Stevie Ray Vaughan kind of a thing, you know. And I got it in one pass, and it was like, I just nailed it, you know. It was incredible. And then Harry was so proud, you know.
Wow. Well, how did that lead to, or did it lead to more studio work? Or, I mean, was that a one-off and you walked out of the studio and said, that was fun? Or did you say, I want to do more of that?
Well, Jim Keltner was the drummer on the session, and Jim called me like the next day to come and do some, and book me to do two more sessions on other things. And I remember, like, I showed up at this session, and it was like a real session with charts. And I never have been a great reader of music, but this was like a two music stand charts, you know. And the piano player was a guy named Dave Benoit. And so I knew to just run over to him and befriend him. And he have him play the chart for me. And I just kind of worked it out by ear, which is much like what I do today. You know?
Are there kind of guitar heroes of yours that you've not tried to emulate, but who you can look at their career and say, that's a life, that's something to aspire towards?
My first guitar heroes were the Beatles and George Harrison, and then went to the Rolling Stones, and it was Mick Taylor, who was playing slide guitar, and I didn't even realize he was playing slide guitar. So I was, you know, putting the record back and the needle back and trying to figure out what he was doing without a slide, and sort of emulating that sound without even knowing what a bottleneck was.
That brings up another thought, which is kind of that whole woodshedding idea. That someone does when they're young. Describe what you were doing.
I guess it's, I mean, when I read about other guitar players, everybody seems to have started for the same reason. It was sort of because of the attention that I got from girls, I think. You know, and I remember, like, when I learned, I was sort of woodshedding Jimmy Page, because if you could play Over the Hills and Far Away or The Rain Song or Stairway to Heaven, you would immediately have girls sitting around eating their lunch with you, you know. Which was great, you know. So that was sort of the initial inspiration. I remember one girl, I think I was like 12, like really loved all the Led Zeppelin songs, and she called me and invited me to meet her in UCLA by the fountain. And I was just totally terrified of her, because I think she was like 13 or 14, much more, you know, mature than I was. And I went down there and we listened. She had a little lunchbox Panasonic cassette deck, and we listened to Led Zeppelin songs. And Led Zeppelin was like just like fueled with like sexual energy, you know. And I just remember sitting there with her, and my brothers were like, oh yeah, you're so in, you know, I was so nervous. And she just scared the crap out of me. But I sat there with her and listened to, you know, that didn't go any farther. I didn't go, you know.
There's no basis.
Back to her place at 12. Yeah, no basis covered.
I'm assuming, you know, at some point you said, this is me, this is what I do, right?
I knew from when I was 8 years old, you know.
Now tell me about that.
Well,
you say that.
Yeah, my stepdad, you know, bought me and my brothers guitars one Christmas, you know, under the Christmas tree. There was a bunch of guitar cases, and, from very early on, my brother and I, my brother Paul took to guitar playing. He's a really good guitar player himself, took to it right away, and we put together a little band, and we used to play at parties. You know, I remember my brother called my mother when I was like 8 years old and said, hey, can Val come to play the dance at camp, you know? And she got me out of bed and got me out of my pajamas and drove me out to the valley to some camp that he was going to, and I played at a dance, and, you know, I was just like, you know, I just knew from that point on it was all that I wanted to do, you know? I remember being very sleepy, you know, like playing, I was the bass player, you know? And then that we actually went in that band, the McCallum Brothers band. My brother went to school with the Jackson Five, a school called Walton in the Valley. And my first gig, the McCallum Brothers Band's first concert, was, you know, a recital at that school. And Michael Jackson and I actually arranged the tables in the auditorium together.
You're kidding.
The two of us. No, Michael was, I guess, he was about my brother's age. So he was about 13 and I was 8. And we set up the auditorium. And, you know, I remember my uncle used to drop my brother and I, my brother off at school. And the Jacksons would be out front, you know, standing there in the, on the lawn in front of the school. They would just, it'd look like the cartoon of the Jacksons, you know, the Jackson 5, there they are.
That brings up so many questions. You grew up in Los Angeles. You had famous parents. These encounters were just kind of in your circle.
They kind of were. I mean, you know, I went to a school called the Lycée when I was a kid, a French school in Culver City. And in my class, in my grade, were Tatum O'Neill and Jodie Foster. And at some point, Tatum mentioned that her brother was a drummer and that I should come over and play. And that was actually, I think I was about 13 at that point. So it was about 5 years after the initial Michael Jackson encounter at Walton. But I ended up sort of jamming with Michael again because Michael, so I went over to Tatum's, to Ryan O'Neill's house, to jam with her brother, Griffin. And Jackson, Michael Jackson was there. And Michael sat in with us and played drums, and he's an amazing drummer, you know. Like, you know, he cranked up the drum stool as high as it would go, and it still wasn't as high enough for his style. And then he put like two phone books on top of that, and he had this, like, he was almost standing up straight. And we jammed, you know. It's all sort of like a dream. I can't even believe that any of it happened to me. It feels, much of my sort of life feels that way.
Wow. You know, you've made this incredibly personal record called At the End of the Day, which you've
Thank
just
you.
Put out. And, you know, I listened to it, and it's really one of those records that rewards you for sitting down and listening to it and putting everything else down and just kind of paying attention to the record. Was that intentional to create that mood?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was definitely the goal for me, having over the years attempted to do solo projects and sort of failed because the music really wasn't personal to me. And I didn't, you know, believe myself singing songs that kind of I really had nothing to do with. So, you know, I actually had a lot of songs. That, you know, the whole thing started a few years ago when somebody offered me studio time in exchange for me playing on their music. And it was in a really nice studio. So I kind of thought, well, maybe I should get into this songwriting and give it a shot, you know, one more time. Because actually I did make a record in the 90s and I got a record deal, and it was, you know, I'd set out for a publishing deal. I'd written a bunch of songs that I was, you know, trying to sell, you know, not perform. And the record company really liked my demos, and so I signed a record deal, you know, like a $300,000 record deal that I couldn't turn down, but I really didn't want, you know, I didn't really want to do these songs. I didn't believe myself singing these songs. And then I ended up getting dropped because they deemed it as commercially not commercial, you know. And I was really relieved at the time, but it was kind of a mess. And I didn't really want to write songs after that. It was just really disappointing. And so I stopped. But when this friend offered me the studio time, I decided to get back into it. And I started writing. And so I wrote, you know, in the last 4 or 5 years, you know, about 40 songs with different people. And as I went, I got better at it and better at it. And the songs that ended up on At the End of the Day on the record are really sort of the best of the bunch. And you know, definitely the most personal. And you know, and I actually had recorded those songs once before, and even twice before, some of them, trying to kind of find my way into them and find, you know, the challenge for me is how to be believable as a singer, you know. It's not so much about guitar playing, you know. That's really the easy part. But and I'd kind of given up on it, you know. I recorded the songs. I never really believed my performances. So I got together with a producer named Tony Berg and kind of told him the story, and I played him the songs that I had, and he said, well, just play them for me in your living room, in my living room, you know. So I sat down with the acoustic guitar and played him the songs, and he loved them. And he just said, these songs are fantastic, and this is exactly how you need to record them. You know, it's so inviting, and it's, you know. So that's what we did. We just, I showed up at his studio before his real session started, you know, because he makes so many records. And I show up at like 10 and record one song and be done by 11:30. And when we had 10, you know, we did some overdubbing and just let it be really simple and intimate.
You are such a monster guitar player and a craftsman, and you have complete confidence as a guitar player, and you didn't believe yourself as a singer or as a songwriter. And yet, to me, this record you made is probably one of my most favorite, if not my favorite thing you've done. And it makes you wonder, did that experience before you were ready, or that horrible record company response of not being commercial, did it kill something for a long time that, you know, that was waiting inside you to come out?
Well, you know, the songs that I had back then, I didn't believe in, you know.
Tell me about believing in a song, because you've said that twice.
Well,
what does that mean?
I think it's just, for me, it's really lyrically, you know, it's about the lyrics. And I think it just means I have to be able to relate to it, and it has to be personal to me, or I can't do it. I'm just, you know, maybe if I was a teenager, you know, I don't think I wouldn't have been interested even then in singing songs, you know, just schlocky, you know, pop songs. You know, I wrote some songs with some talented friends, and with no interest in singing them myself, but I had to demo them, and the demos were really good, so people liked them, but they were just, you know, they weren't anything that I would listen to. And that's kind of the bottom line for me. It has to be something that I would put in and listen to and enjoy. You know.
It's also, you know, when I listen to it, it is so personal, and it's a record about loss, and it's about healing and about moving on. And it really does have a story, the whole record, not just per song, but I hear a beginning, a middle, and an end. And, you know, when I listen to it, particularly songs like Deal With It and Rare Bird and Ghost Town, and I know a little bit about your family history, but I get the sense through those stories, those songs, that kind of everyone that loved you and protected you, they're gone. From that period in your life, that vulnerable period, and it seems to be like it's that kind of record. And here's a man facing a complicated world on his own. Is there truth to that?
Absolutely, that's totally true. And you know, I had you know, I lost my mother to cancer, and I had a brother who was 9 months older than me, who I was really close with, passed away just 6 months before her. So I lost those two within a year. And, you know, and I knew that at some point I was going to, you know, write about it, you know. I wanted to have a record, you know, that was kind of not to be cathartic, you know, but like something that, you know, I knew that there was stuff there that was going to be something that I could get behind, you know, one day and write about. I wrote Rare Bird just right after my mother passed away. And actually, I wrote Deal With It with my mother right after my brother passed away. So I wrote Deal With It, you know, 3 months after Jason died, and 3 months later, with my mom, and 3 months later she died. You know, so that song is, you know, it had to be done. It had to be recorded. So that's sort of part of the reason that I persisted, you know, to do it.
Your brother Jason was 9 months apart from you. You must have been very close with him.
Yeah, we were raised like twins, you know. He was amazing. And, you know, I mean, he had a really bad drug problem, and really early on, and you know, But, you know, he was great. He really enjoyed his 26 years. He lived, he was a lot of fun. And I feel lucky to have had those years with him, you know.
I want to play a little piece of Deal With It, which you said you wrote with your mom.
And we wrote the song, and she was so happy that she was now a songwriter, you know. I mean, she was so happy with it that I remember we wrote it, and it was around Valentine's Day. So, and she was really sick. You know, she was like, I want to buy you a pair of cowboy boots, you know. This is so exciting. We have to do something fun. Let's go buy some cowboy boots on Melrose. And I drove her from Malibu to Melrose to buy me a pair of really gaudy green lizard skin cowboy boots that I actually think I gave to somebody when I was on the road. I wish I had them now. God.
Well, I listened to this song, and I want to play the second verse, which describes your father's reaction at the funeral, and let's listen to it. But it's so evocative. You can see the whole scene in this song, and I just want to hear a little bit of it, and then we can talk a little bit about it.
I turned my head aside as our father watched and cried. Such a strong man, down on his knees, helpless to help you to deal with it.
I imagine you being a pallbearer at your brother's funeral and seeing your father, you know, the way you described it, turning away. You must have just felt like your life was unchanged at that point.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I went into I was pretty anesthetized, you know, through it. And it's a little bit hazy at this point. But that moment that lyric came from a very real image, you know.
So there's a line in Deal With It, and I'd love to just, you know, talk about that for a second, because it's heartbreaking to someone who, you know, I have a brother and I have sisters, but I never had anyone close like that, almost like a twin. And you say, I always thought it would be me and you. And to me, that's kind of like the emotion that underscores this whole record. Like, how did I end up alone here with all my closest people? And, you know, that's the emotion I feel coming out of the record. Is there some sense to that?
Yeah, I mean, that's it.
When you say that, were you kind of, you two kind of inseparable? You spent a lot
of time? We really were, you know. I mean, you know, we were in bunk beds as kids, and we always were taken everywhere together. I mean, we were literally raised like twins, you know. And, you know, when I started working professionally, Jason was into music like nobody else. I mean, he was obsessed with the Rolling Stones. When he was 8 years old, he got our governess to drive him to the Beverly Hills Hotel. He knew that Mick Jagger was staying there. He found his way to Jagger's suite, knocked on the door. Bianca let him in and gave him a bunch of swag, gave him a bunch of t-shirts. And he came home with all this stuff. He's like, yeah. And the governess was like, yeah, you know. They made it to Mick's suite.
So a young kid going to the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Yeah.
Now, questionable.
He had all the Stones records on all that. He had them on Decca and all the various labels that they were on. He had a collection. He was obsessed with the Rolling Stones. And, you know, my stepdad actually sort of may have blamed the Rolling Stones for his drug problem, Keith Richards, and, you know. But, you know, I mean, when I was, one of my first touring jobs was with Ivan Neville, and we opened for Keith Richards. I was in Ivan's band, and we did the Expensive Winos tour. And so Jason got to see me do that. Like, it wasn't long before he passed away. And he went on the road with us, and he would show up in various towns and, you know, trash my hotel rooms. He trashed my room at the Ritz-Carlton in Atlanta. which I had to pay for, a vase, a few things.
So he was wild.
He was like doing what I was supposed to be doing, you know. And it was sad, you know. We would check out of the hotel and he'd still be down in the lobby just raging with some strangers, you know. I'd see him I'd bump into him at the, he didn't actually travel on the bus with us. There really wasn't room. So I'd see him in various airports, like with no money. And I gave him thousands and twenties, you know. Like, and it was hard, you know. But he was having a great time and he was so proud of me.
Did his death make you make some decisions about how to live your life?
It scared me, you know. I mean, it definitely, it did. Everything changed from that point on, you know. I mean, I basically went through a period of, like, not wanting to leave the house, you know, just sort of feeling like, is this going to happen to me, you know. Because, you know, my mother and him passing away so close to you, it was just feeling like people were, you know, they just dropping around me. And, you know, and then actually, like, just right after my mom died, like, minutes after she died, I had auditioned for Wilson Phillips, you know, a few weeks before. And, like, my mom passed away, and I was just sort of sitting outside, and somebody came and said there was a phone call for me, and I had gotten this job to go on the road with Wilson Phillips. And I was like, yeah, yes, please, you know. So I just took off and went on the road, which was sort of the perfect thing to do, and that's when I met my wife. Right.
You end the album with Rare Bird, which is a song that you wrote without any co-writers.
Yeah.
And it is about your mom. I want to play just a little bit of that, just to get us in the mood to talk about it.
There's a gold.
People that everybody loved that met her. I mean, you know, she was an incredibly sweet, you know, sensitive person who loved to laugh and, you know, really positive. And, you know, just anybody who ever met her kind of came away from it feeling charmed, you know. I mean, she was one of those people, you know, you just don't really. You know, I mean, it's sad. The more years go by, the less I bump into people that knew her, you know, that have things to say about her, about, you know, how amazing that she was. I mean, she truly was.
Is there a particular memory that you have of her that kind of describes her to a T? Like buying the alligator boots or?
My favorite memories of my mom are in the car singing together. And my mom was, you know, could sing, but she was British, and she sort of had, she loved soul music, and I used to ride in the car with her and sing along with Harry Nilsson and Bonnie Raitt, and, you know, like 8 tracks, you know, like everything from John Denver, you know, the Eagles. So that's sort of my favorite memories, were just singing together with her in the car, you know.
One last thing on Deal With It, because I know you wrote it with her. It seems like almost that was her telling you that we're going to have to deal with this. That, and I think of what must it be like to lose a son and have to console your other son when you're a wreck yourself. Was she strong during that period with you?
No, she was, you know, on her way out, you know. She was really, really sick. When we wrote that, And I was really sick, actually. I remember I had like a horrible flu, and I was staying in her pool house in Malibu, and she was, you know, was going through chemo and radiation and didn't have any hair on her head and just looked like, you know, I mean, it was, the end was really near. And when my brother died, and it was clear that she'd given up. But so when we wrote that song, and it was, you know, it was my suggestion that we try to write something. And I sort of did that for myself. And it ended up being a really positive thing for her. She was so proud of it, you know, she loved it. And actually, I recorded it before she died. And it was a very different piece of music when we wrote it initially. It was a little more, and I, you know, I put a string quartet on it. And I wanted to give it to her, you know, so that she could hear a song that she had written. And it was really beautiful, and she was so proud of it. So I sort of felt great to give her that. And then, you know, she gave me a gift too.
Is having these experiences, you think, what you've gone through in your life, do you use that? Does it inform you as a dad?
It's funny, you know, when you become a parent, I always look back on my parents, and I always, when I think of them, I always think of them as amazing parents, and I've always told everybody, oh, I had the greatest parents. And they're great people, and they were really sweet people. But being a parent makes you look at it very, very differently, you know. And there were certain things that they did that I, you know, looking at as a father of a five-year-old, I can't, you know. So like, I had my own hotel room on the 10th floor in a hotel in Almeria in Spain, you know, like with a balcony that I could access at, like 6-7 years old, you know. And I remember my brother Jason had a room next to me when Charlie was on location, and I used to crawl on the ledge from my room to his room.
Oh my God.
You know, things like that, you know, it's like, I can't imagine doing that, you know.
You've made records with Lucinda Williams, with Jackson Brown, you've made records with all kinds of people, and often you're asked to go on the road with them. In the case of Jackson, sometimes for long stretches of time. And I wonder how that's changed since you've become a father, how the experience...
I stopped. I stopped going on the road. It's really hard, especially when you're on the East Coast, because you want to, you know, I want to say goodnight, you know. And but Jackson does a long sound check, and then actually we call it the matinee. I don't hold it against him. I actually have a lot in common with Jackson, and I understand, you know, he wants it to be just so, and you know, and we use that time to rehearse and work up new songs, and he's got a lot of songs, you know, so he's adding songs, and but it makes it difficult because, you know, the 3 hours later thing on the East Coast, you know, after sound check, you want to try to have dinner, you want to get dressed, and that's sort of the time that I call home, so I sort of find myself. Was very, you know, little time to connect on the phone. You know, I'm always like calling right before I got to go on stage, you know, which is hard. So I try to call in the morning too, you know, before she goes to school or, you know. But it's really hard, and there's some times where it's just, you know, it's debilitating how sort of, how you miss somebody. You know, it's, being a single parent is not something that I could do, you know, so I feel for my wife, you know, it's really hard, you know, but, and you know, sometimes I worry that Stella's missing me, and this, you know, and I know that, you know, Shelley keeps her really busy, and that, you know, it's sort of like she's on to the next thing. If you keep them fun things for her to do, you know, I think that she's okay, and she's probably not suffering as much as I feel like she is, and not having me around. I know it's hard, you know, but you're right. You know, I'm kind of laying the groundwork right now. It's now or never. You know, I'm not getting any younger.
I wonder what you consider maybe some of your own shortcomings or weaknesses, because it's easy to say, "Hey, here's this guy, and he made a record, and he plays with all these amazing musicians and all that. But what do you consider to be some of your shortcomings?
I don't think I have any. I think probably the fact that I didn't really spend much time with the academics. And, I never became a particularly literate musician. You know, I work with some pretty heavy people, and, with Mitchell, he'll call me to do, like, Randy Newman sessions. And I was doing a session, I forget what movie, what Toy Story or something, but I remember when I was in the studio that it was a lot of sheet music, and we were running it down, and I was just doing my bluff, you know, just basically playing whatever the F I want. And, usually they like it. And Randy came over and he stood behind me. And I was playing and I was like, oh no, you know. The deal's up here, you know. And I looked up and he was looking at me with a funny smile on his face, shaking his head like, you know. But, you know, I didn't get in my car and run away like I wanted to, you know.
I think being an artist, there's always a certain bit of that in your head, like, is today the day when they all figure it out, and I won't fool them anymore. I mean, do you ever feel that way, that you're kind of getting away with it?
No, because I've done this so long now. I used to have that feeling, you know, but now, at a certain point, you've done enough in your career so that the thought that it just doesn't matter anymore. I've kind of already achieved what I wanted in a way. You know, there's a certain, you know, which kind of, you know, freed me up to kind of really become, to get good at what I do, you know. It just, at a certain point, it didn't matter if I failed. Like, if I don't get this and the producer's not happy and I go home and they didn't get what they wanted, you know, it doesn't matter that much, you know. It's not the end of the day. I mean, it's not the end of the world.
So you're saying almost in a way that you got to get to the point where you don't care to take the next step to get really good.
And then you're free to sort of to really be creative, you know, and that takes the pressure off, you know. That actually happened at that point, you know, maybe 10 years ago or something, I think. I think I got much better.
Did it,
as a player,
did it feel like a weight being lifted off your shoulders?
Kind of.
I mean, did you mark the moment? Did you actually take note of it?
Kind of. I used to be really stressed out. Before, you know, a new producer would call. Somebody would call. You know, I used to get referred by Michael Landau, who's like my favorite guitar player in L.A. And he used to send me work. And every time I'd get a message from him, I'd be, oh crap, you know, like, you know, can you be in the house guitar player in the VH1 Honors show? You know, I'm backing up Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, Peter Gabriel, you know, Natalie Merchant, Michael Stipe, all in one show. You know, I mean, I was a mess before these things. You know, actually, I would probably still be a mess if I got a call like that. But I remember I used to get calls that I would get really nervous for. And I don't anymore, really.
You know, it's funny you say about 10, 12 years ago that this happened, and it kind of coincides with the rise of Jack Shit, your band.
Exactly.
And, you know, I want to talk
about
the
rise of Jack Shit. That sounds like baking or something.
You know, I've seen the show many times, and when I take someone new to see a Jack Shit show, it's hard to describe because I want to say, hey, you're going to have a great time, you're going to laugh your ass off, and it's going to be a riot. But that kind of undersells the level of playing, the level of musicality that the band has. And it's kind of one of those things that's, the music's deadly serious, but the guys on stage are just taking the piss out of it, to borrow an expression from, you know, the English.
Which is the reason everybody loves it. I've never had anybody not love Jack Shit, you know? And I think that's totally the reason, is because we're not taking ourselves too seriously.
How did it start? How did Jack Shit start?
Well, Jack Shit are three fictitious characters from a town called Coctoten, California, which is 90 miles south of Bakersfield. I'm Bo Shit. Davey Farragher is Shorty shit. And Pete Thomas, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame drummer, is piece of shit. We were Vonda Shepherd's backup band for Ally McBeal, which was a great gig to have. Vonda's super talented singer, and was at a stage in her career where she really knew how to put together a really good band and how to keep really good players. And she got us all singing backgrounds and getting paid through SAG, and you know, and it was this wonderful gig that we had. And but we did have to do the on-camera stuff for the show, which, you know, could be 14, 15-hour days of sitting around in a trailer.
Meaning on television,
on
if
set.
You looked in the background, there's the band, and you guys are actors.
Yep. Vonda had, in every episode, had a scene in the bar that she would sing a song that we pre-recorded. And we would go and be her band on camera as well as in the studio. But you know how that goes. You sit around and wait for 10, 11 hours before you're seen, you know. So we put together the group. You know, we would sit around in the trailer and playing Graham Parsons songs, and we decided to put together the band.
What is the vision of Jack Shit?
The vision of Jack Shit. you know. Well, I think the vision is that it's a place where we can get together and play music, and nobody will tell us what to do, and or how to play our instruments, and we're not allowed to tell each other how to play, you know.
But you're mining a very specific and great period in American music, kind of the country and western, the honky tonk, and a bit of even the newer, the Graham Parsons, the Leuven Brothers, and kind of the pop radio of Nashville, say, in the 40s, 50s, 60s,
yeah.
That kind of thing. I mean, that's a great, great part of the American songbook, and you don't hear it a lot of places. So I get the sense that part of it is very serious for you guys.
Yeah, definitely. We all love that style, you know, that genre. And yeah, Pete especially, you know, coming from England, it's just anything Americana, you know, for Pete, he's very dead serious about.
On stage, you know, you're in Western shirts, you got your cowboy hats, you got your accents and your big cowboy boots. And is there a freedom to being a character? And do you let that idea spill into your guitar playing as well?
I think so, you know. I think Bo Shit is free to let it all hang out, you know. I mean, he's not worried about being subtle or tasteful, you know. He's up there to have a good time and show people what he's got, you know. So I think so, you know. I mean, it's so much fun. You know, and you know, we've taken Jack Shit to Tulsa, Oklahoma. We play in Indian gaming casinos, where people actually maybe don't understand that we are kidding. You know, and I've had old cowboys come up to me and say, you know, son, you know, were you in Bakersfield back when there was sand in the irrigation? You know, do you remember the? You know, I'm like, well, no, sir, we're actually full of shit. You know.
And do you see continuing on? Is it just a great? Is it a great kind of release? You know, it's funny. Anyone else with a real job, you wouldn't expect a lawyer to go home and put together a little group of lawyers to go have some fun writing.
That's
briefs.
Funny. Yeah, you know, I mean, we just love playing together. It is so much fun. You know, we're working together all the time. So it's funny you say that. We're just finished making a record with Sharon Corr from the Corrs, the three of us, with Mitchell Froom, and so. You know, I mean, sometimes we play a lot, and I start thinking, oh, maybe we're playing too much, but every time we get to crank it up and get going. You know, I'm always amazed at how comfortable I am playing with these guys. You know, Davey and Peter, a premier rhythm section. Like, I'm so lucky to get to play with, you know, the best bass player, period, that I know. And Pete, who's just, you know, an incredible drummer.
Now, just their day job as well is they are the rhythm section for Elvis Costello now.
Yeah.
So, you know, you guys are all playing all the time. You're going on the road. You're doing records. I think it's a testament. It's proof that you love music because you still want to do it when you don't have to.
Yeah, but to do it on our own terms is kind of a big thing, you know. You know, I think in every other scenario, we're having to do, you know, it a certain way. You know, when you're working for someone, you got to play it the way they want you to play it. You know, I mean, in most cases, like for me, people hire me because they want me to do my thing. But really, at the end of the day, it's you're doing what you want, what you think they want to hear. You know, when we do jack shit, we're just having a ball. You know.
Are friendships forged through playing music different or deeper than social friendships through, you know, how other walks of life?
Well, I think so, you know. You know, I think being in a group of musicians and in bands, even thrown together bands doing sessions, you know, you find yourself sitting in the lounge talking, and then and before you know it, it feels like you're in a group therapy or something, you know, like, you know, I think there's something to be said for that. I've always sort of wished that my wife was a musician for that, because she loves to communicate, and, you know, I feel really lucky to have that. And that's also the reason that I don't go to therapy. Because it's built into my career.
I think from the outside looking in, though, you know, when you see a group of guys or a band that can really play together, it's enviable. It's enviable to see it's all an inside joke or an inside communication, because you know what the other person's going to do because you've heard them do it 1,000 times. And I always look at that as, you know, almost like what you picture maybe cowboys would have been like 100 years ago, when they had to spend all their time together and they're out riding the range and doing work together. And I don't know, in this day and age, we spend so much solitary time, so much time on our devices in front of our computers. Maybe we don't get to forge those kind of friendships that, you know, something, maybe, I guess I'm asking if jack shit is also an excuse to spend time with your buddies.
Yeah, I think that hits the nail on the head, really, you know. I mean, we're like buddies, we're like brothers. I mean, at this point, we've been doing it for 12 years now. I mean, it's, you know, we love each other, we hate each other, we drive each other crazy, you know. I mean, you know, I just did a gig, my own gig, and I used this young girl who's wonderful, named Danielle Heim on drums. And it was like, she's awesome, as different from Pete as I could find. And that's what I was looking for, you know. It took me so far out of my comfort zone to, you know. And then getting back together with Pete and with Davey, you know, it just feels like, you know, being in a family band or something, you know. I mean, it's, we're just joined at the hip. We know exactly what each other's going to do.
So what's next? Are you, has this experience made you want to make more records and keep going with this?
Yeah, definitely it has.
Has it kind of refreshed your career or your feeling about what you do?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely want to, I'm already sort of thinking about what I want to do next, you know. And Jackson keeps asking me, are you writing, you know, which is really sort of intimidating. To have him ask. I mean, I consider Jackson to be one of the great lyricists, you know, of all time. It's funny, we were on the bus, you know, we woke up at 5 a.m, his bunk was across from mine, and we both kind of flopped our legs out, and he was like, "You fit in your bunk?" I said, "No, I don't fit in my bunk." And then he said, he's like, "You know, in Spain, you know, the beds are really small, and Dion and I have to take turns sleeping diagonally so each of us can stretch out." And we start having this strange, groggy conversation. And I said, "So there's no California Kings in Spain, you know?" And he says, "There's your next record title, you know?" And then he went off on a tangent. He was about a song that he was writing, you know, and he started explaining like about a lyric and the process of how he's writing the song. And like, and here I am like hearing how Jackson writes, you know, his process, you know, and it was just, it's a bit overwhelming at times, you know. I really do want to write another record, but sometimes I feel like, you know.
Well, but what an opportunity to have kind of a masterclass from, you know, Jackson Browne in little snippets of conversation about songwriting. Well, I mean,
I know.
Do you sometimes stop and say, look what I'm doing on a daily basis, or has it become just so regular to you that it doesn't cross your mind anymore?
No, it crosses my mind all the time. Yeah. It's just, I do, you know, on this last tour we did, there were so many shows that I just wished I had some people at because they were so special, so great. We do all these gigs in these towns that aren't New York and aren't LA and aren't Nashville, you know, that I don't know anybody. And these magical things will happen, you know, like one night he did, and he's sort of been, it's a very casual forum, that the way we're doing the show, it's just me and him and Fritz Lewak on drums, and it just feels like we're playing in our living room. He calls it the comforts of home tour. You know, he's got 40 guitars, you know, I've got 12, you know, like we brought everything that we from home that we could possibly want. And there's carpets on the stage, you know, and somebody asked for opening farewell, you know, and the audience is yelling out requests, and Jackson just all night we're just taking requests. And you know, and which was one of my mother's favorite songs, and it's this beautiful song. His Bonnie Raitt did a great cover of, and you know, and I think I said during, you know, I said, oh, that's one of my mom's favorites, you know, and we started having a conversation, you know, like he's engaging me, you know, during the show, and then it's like one of those moments that I was just like, shit, I wish someone was here for this, you know. And then we played the song, which I've never played with him, but I know it, you know. Or actually, we played the song, and he was sort of surprised that I knew it, you know. And then I said, well, actually, you know, that was one of my mom's favorites. And it's also, you know, it's just, the song has a lot of meaning for me, you know.
What I hear is that you want to take those moments, and you do. You want to be able to share them with people.
Yeah.
You want to be able to share... Like, I mean, in a way, would you say this is the culmination of everything you've done so far? Is that you're up there getting to be entirely yourself as a guitar player? You're getting to just be you and in conversation, and your family's woven into it, and you're making your own record. I look at it as, and I say, what a great place to be in, you know, at this point to be able to be yourself and not feel stress about it and know who you are and to be able to write about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think, you know, this might be the apex.
It's all downhill from here.
It's all downhill from here. Yeah.
Well, listen, it's been a great pleasure having you on the show. Thank you for coming on and especially for being our first guest. And I'd love to have you back anytime. Make another record, come back, and we'll talk some more.
Thank you, Sam. It was really fun.
Thanks a lot.
You have just finished listening to another episode of Off Camera. To access more episodes, subscribe, and be a part of the entire Off Camera experience, please visit offcamera.com. This has been a presentation of the NTD Broadcast Network.